Signal, Close, Action. Written by Alexander Kent and read by Michael Jaston.
Like leviathans afloat lay their bulwarks on the brine, while the sign of battle flew on the lofty British line. Campbell. Chapter 1. The Squadron. Beneath Gibraltar's towering and craggy protection, the mixed collection of anchored shipping tugged at their cables and waited for the sudden squall to abate. Despite streaks of pale blue, which showed themselves occasionally between the brisk clouds, the air was cold, with a bite in it more common in the Bay of Biscay than the Mediterranean. Considering its strategic importance, Gibraltar's anchorage was unusually deserted. A few storeships, some brigs and schooners finding shelter or awaiting orders, made up the bulk of vessels there, and of major men-of-war, there were but three. Anchored, well apart from the other hotchpotch of local craft, were three ships of the line, 74s, which in this month of January 1798 were still the most popular and the most adaptable vessels in any plan of battle. The one anchored nearest to the land bore the name Lysander across her broad counter, a name to match the figurehead which stared angrily from beneath her bowsprit. It was a fine figurehead, with a black-bearded Spartan general, adorned in crested helmet and breastplate, originally carved by Henry Calloway of Deptford. Like the rest of the big two-decker, it was well-painted, with a look of newness which belied the ship's 11 long years in the King's service. Back and forth, up and down her wide quarter-deck, her captain, Thomas Herrick, walked with barely a pause to peer towards the shore. If he considered his ship's appearance and condition, it was more from anxiety than pride. The months of work in England to get Lysander ready for sea, the whole wearing business of recommissioning and gathering what amounted to practically a raw company, had gone on without a pause. Stores and powder, water and provisions, weapons and the men to handle them. Herrick had more than once questioned the fates which had given him his new command. And yet, despite the delays and infuriating slackness amongst the dockyard men and chandlers, he had seen his ship grow from a disorganized chaos to a living, vital creature. Frightened men, brought aboard by the unrelenting press gangs, and others gathered by motives as varied as patriotism, or merely fleeing into the navy to avoid a hangman's halter, had been slowly and painstakingly moulded into something which, if still far from perfect, could offer hope for the future. The first squall in the bay, as Lysander had crawled south towards Portugal, had brought some weakness to light. Too many seasoned hands in one watch, too many landsmen in another. But under Herrick's careful watch and the efforts of Lysander's remaining backbone of professional warrant officers, they had at least come to terms with the awesome maze of rigging, the rebellious and treacherous folds of canvas which made up their daily lives at sea. Once at anchor below the rock, Herrick had waited with growing apprehension for this particular day. More ships had arrived and anchored nearby. The other two 74s, Osiris and Nicator, the frigate Buzzard, and the little sloop of war, Harebell, were no longer separate entities, but part of a whole. By order of the Admiralty in London, they had become one. The squadron, in which Herrick's ship would hoist the broad pendant of Commodore, and over which and through all imaginable circumstances, Richard Bolitho would at any moment now be exercising his right of command. It was strange when Herrick hesitated to consider the matter. It was only 4 months since he and Bolitho had returned to England from this same sea. After a bloody battle, in which Herrick's own ship had been destroyed, and a complete French squadron routed or taken, they had gone to the Admiralty together. It still seemed like a dream, a memory of long past. The result of that visit had been far-reaching. For Richard Bolitho, an immediate promotion to Commodore, and for Herrick, the post of flag captain. Their admiral had been less fortunate. Packed off to govern a penal colony in New South Wales, the very swiftness of his fall from grace had somehow measured the step between authority and oblivion.